Daf Chav Dalet Omer Aleph. Let's go over the Mishnah. We divided up the Mishnah into a few different parts.
What character?
And we're learning the fourth parak of Sota. And we're looking on Daf Chav Dalet. I'm just going to quickly review what we did on Thursday, or Wednesday, whenever it was we got together. I don't remember anymore. And the Mishnah was talking about those cases of a woman who is excluded from drinking the Mayim Marorim. And the Mishnah is going to talk about other cases where she is included in drinking the Mayim HaMarorim, the Gemara. And the Mishnah is always going to be sensitive to two other issues. Does she get the Ksuba? Does she not collect her Ksuba in a case where she doesn't drink from the Mayim Marorim? And is she allowed to resume her relationship with her husband in cases where she doesn't drink from the Mayim Marorim? Those are all the three issues that we want to address. So in the first category, these are ladies who do not drink from Mayim Marorim, and the reason for that is because their Ishus relationship is incomplete. They're not completely married. And the two examples are, number one, an Arusa. Arusa means that he said to her, Re'at Mekudeshesli, he married her with a Kesef, he gave her a Tabas, and this was done in front of two witnesses, but there hasn't yet have Nisuin. It's before Chuk. It's before the Nisuin took place. So she's married, but she's not totally married. Another case would be Shomeres Yavam, which means a woman whose husband died, and she has a brother-in-law, correct? So she falls for Yibum in front of her brother-in-law, and at this point, her relationship is called a Zikas Yibum. She's not allowed to have a relationship with any other man until she gets Chalitza. And in such a case, the Mishnah says, Lo Shosos Velo Notlos Ksuba. So they're excluded from drinking Mayim Marorim because the marriage is not complete. The Gemara is going to derive from the Pasuk, Asher Tista Isha Tachas Isha. Isha means it's a full-fledged marriage relationship. Prat to the exclusion of Arusa and Shomer Siyob, because those two cases that we discussed in great length last week are not full marriage relationship. However, she does lose her ksuba. Now, why does she lose her ksuba? That's because of Kini and Stira, right? So even in all these cases, there was Kini and Stira, and once she has that Kini and Stira relationship, she loses her rights to the ksuba. Then we get to another case. And the next case is where it's a full-fledged Ishus. They're totally, totally married, but it's a non-kosher Ishus, meaning the Torah is opposed to their having married. The Torah is going to say you have to divorce your wife. For example, a Kohen Gadol who marries an Almana, meaning a woman who already was married in the past. A Kohen Hedjo, which means a regular rank-and-file Kohen who marries a Grusha, a woman who was divorced, in a divorcee, I guess you'd call it in English, or a man who's married to a mamzeres. In all these cases, we wrote on the blackboard, maybe it's still even up here, yeah, chai ve'lavim, look at that, nobody erased it, that's amazing. Chai ve'lavim, chai ve'lavim means we're dealing with a case not of kares, but of a lav, when the Torah prohibits this relationship with a lav, and in such a case, it's not a kosher marriage, we're going to force him to divorce his wife, and she does not drink from the Mayim Marorim. So again, there are two conditions here. Condition number one was it's got to be a complete Ishus, a complete marriage, to the exclusion of Arusa and Shomer Siyavav. Condition number two, it has to be a kosher marriage, to the exclusion of the cases that we mentioned before, like Kohen Gadol who's marrying an Almana, or a Kohen Hedjer who's marrying a Grusha, or a man who marries a Mamzeres. In all those cases, we exclude Mayim HaMarorim. What about Ksuba? The Mishnah goes on to tell us that in these cases, lo notlos ksuba, they do not get a ksuba. Again, because of what? Kinui and stira. Let's not forget that. So she loses her rights to ksuba because she violated his kinui and she went into this secluded place with that man as she shouldn't have done. Now we go on to the next case of the Mishnah. Now the Mishnah is talking about a case of women who don't drink the Mayim Marorim because of various details. Well, the first detail is when she herself admits that she had this adulterous relationship. That's called Homeres Tmea Ani. And this you'll see on the third line on Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph. So if you're on 24a, on line 3 in the Mishnah, I'm just reviewing what we did on Thursday. She admits that she had this adulterous relationship. And the Torah is going to tell us that in such a case, she does not drink from the Memorarim.
But what's the Chiddush there? Because any woman who admits she's had the adulterous relationship doesn't drink.
Yeah, you're right. The Gemara is going to ask what the... In every single case, by the way, Alan, as we go through the Gemara, we're going to always ask your same question. Every single case, what is the Chiddush? What would I have thought otherwise? Okay, then? So again, she admits that she was Tmeya, that she had this adulterous relationship, and in such a case, there's no Memorarim. And we'll see how the Gemara derives that from a pasuk that her confession removes her from the parasha of Memorarim. But of course, she loses her ksuba, because by her own admission, she committed this adultery. She doesn't have rights to ksuba. Then we have the next case, where two witnesses testified against her that they saw that she had this adulterous relationship. There's no Memorarim there. And she loses her ksuba, even though she denies the claim of the Edom. She says, I'm guiltless. These are false witnesses. We don't believe her, we believe them. And then we have the next case, which is Omeris Eini Shosa. This is a real chiddush. This is really something new. That she says, I don't want to drink. And the Sota has a right to refuse drinking. And the Gemara is going to derive this from Psukim. And in such a case, once again, she doesn't drink because we need her participation, but she loses her ksuba because just because she says, I don't want to drink, that doesn't give her rights to the ksuba. She already violated the kinui with the stira, and therefore she forfeits her ksuba. So this is really fascinating, because we're going to soon see that the husband also can say, I don't want to bring her to the Beis HaMikdash to have a drink. And or the opposite case where she says she doesn't want to drink. And in both cases there won't be any Memorarim, which is really interesting, that basically to have Memorarim, in addition to all the conditions that we mentioned about Kinui and Stira, we also have to have a mutual consent. Both he and she have to agree that they want to go. Oh, is that yours? Whose phone went off? I think it was my phone. Let me just shut off my phone, sorry. Oh no, my phone is off.
It would seem that fact that she refuses to drink is almost tantamount to admission.
So Rabosa, we're going to have to be patient. I'll tell you why, because until we see the Gemara, and the Gemara is going to go, I'm just giving you the Mishnah as an overview, and then we're going to try to take apart point by point every one of these cases and see why she doesn't drink and so forth and so on. Okay, let's just get the cases down and then we'll shoot to the Gemara. We have Baruch Hashem, we're not pressured for time. We'll be able to go through each case on its own. Amar Bailaini Mashke. What happens? The husband says that she shouldn't drink. Now there's a funny kind of case here, because the answer is that there won't be Mayim Aroran, but does she lose her ksuba? She's claiming that she was guiltless. She's also claiming that she could prove her innocence. How is she going to prove her innocence? She's saying, just give me an opportunity to what?
Drink.
To drink. And he decides that there won't be drinking. So this section of the Mishnah is going to outline a number of cases where he's the cause for her not drinking. The first of which is when he says, I don't want to give her a drink. He doesn't take her to the temple. The second case is, Shabbat Olel Baila Ba'olel Baderech. We're going to soon see that if he has a relationship with her on the way to the Beis HaMikdash, she doesn't drink. In these cases, he's the cause. And now you could ask, what happens if he drops dead? That's going to be an interesting question. That's going to come up in the next section of the Mishnah. But in these cases, clearly he's the one who's preventing her from proving her innocence. And therefore the Mishnah says, no tlos ksuba velo shosos. In these cases, she does have rights to the ksuba. So it's really interesting. We're in a very paradoxical, or shall I say, a very a tug of war. On the one end, she should lose her ksuba because of kinyan and stira. I mean, what kind of business is this behavior that she goes into a secluded room? On the other hand, she wants to claim her innocence, and she wants to prove, give me an opportunity, I'll drink the darn stuff, she says. And he says, no, I'm not going to let you drink. Or he says, he does something else to have this intimate relationship with her. So in this case, the Mishnah says that since her claim was that she was guiltless, therefore she gets rights to her ksuba. He's going to have to pay the ksuba. By the way, as I mentioned to you last week, ksuba is a very serious payment. It's people today think that what's in the ksuba, but the ksuba is a legally binding document. I know when over in Canada, I think there's a province called Manitoba, I'm not sure, but anyway, there was a Manitoba court that the Supreme Court of Manitoba issued a verdict that the ksuba is legally binding. So I don't know if that's true in every country in the face of the world, but it's certainly true in Canada. So this is serious. The Pnei Yehoshua says that the ksuba is worth minimally a full year's support on an average level. I don't know exactly what that would mean. I'm just thinking in American terms, if this means anything to anybody, it would probably be the equivalent of about 50, if not twice that, $50,000 a year. This is not a small amount, besides which a lot of ksubas have what's called a Tosefis ksuba. So this is something that we have to consider. If he makes the decision that she's not going to drink, it's going to cost him. He's going to have to pay from his pocket. Again, he's going to have to divorce her. He has no choice about that, because once she had Kinyan and Stira, they can no longer resume their relationship. And that's true for all the cases that we mentioned. But as to whether he has to pay the ksuba, if he's the cause who's preventing or blocking him from drinking, he's going to have to pay the ksuba, Alan.
But he's admitting guilt.
He's admitting guilt, and therefore he has to pay the ksuba.
Yeah.
Mesu Balem Ad Shalosh Shasu. Okay, now it's a little bit more complicated. This is the gray area. What happens if the husband dies before she drinks from the Mei Merorin? Now, on the one end, he really wanted to go through with this, and she was willing to go through with this. But on the other hand, he died. So can we consider him the cause that blocked her from drinking from the Mei Merorin? So Beit Shammai says, no los ksuba velo shosos.
Just
1 second, let me just get the facts down before you ask me questions. I'm not sure I have all the facts down. So again, let's study Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai say, well, he's the cause. She's willing to drink from the Mei Merorin and prove her innocence. Who blocks her? He blocks her. Why? Because never eres gestorben, as we say in Yiddish. She dropped dead. But Beis Hillel Omrim, O shosos, O lo notlos ksubosan. Now, it sounds like, when you read this literally, that according to Beis Hillel, she could drink, but that's impossible. You can't assume that what Beis Hillel is saying here is that she drinks, because we must have the husband at the time of the drinking, because he has to bring her to the drinking. So what does Beis Hillel mean when he says, O shosos, O lo notlos ksubosan? And basically, I think what Beis Hillel is saying, and I'm kind of going out on a limb here, I hope I'm right, is that if she doesn't drink from the Mei Merorin, she has not proven her innocence, he's not guilty, it's not his fault he's gone already. And now the question is, she's suing the Yorshim, the heirs, the estate, she wants to collect her ksuba, because that's when a woman collects her ksuba when her husband dies. And the Yorshim say, well, we don't want to pay you the ksuba. We don't think that your ksuba is valid, because you never proved your innocence. So Beit Shammai say, well, guess what? She was willing to prove her innocence. And what blocked her is the fact that her husband died. But they still say no. But still say that she doesn't get a ksuba here, because she never proved her innocence. Again, keep in mind, we can never forget that she violated Kinyan and Stira. And once she violates the steer of the keter, she is already in limbo here. Unless she proves her innocence, she loses her ksuba. And in this case, it wasn't he who blocked her in any deliberate way. He didn't kill himself. I don't know about suicide, it'd be an interesting question. But assuming he died a natural death, we're not going to assume that he caused her to not be able to drink from the Mei Merorin. And if he didn't cause her, then the ball is in her court to prove herself. She can't prove herself innocent, and therefore she loses her ksuba, which is great news for the Yorshim. As I said before, the ksuba is a substantial, handsome sum of money. Okay, let's just go on. Just to get the Mishnah down, that's my first goal for our learning. Mu beres chavero. Imagine the following case. A woman is married to, let's call him Reuven, And then, after she becomes pregnant, she still hasn't given birth yet, Reuven gives her a bill of divorce, or Nebuchadnezzar dies, and Shimon comes along and he marries her. Is Shimon allowed to marry her? Rabbi say, listen carefully. I'm going to ask you as a rhetorical question because I don't think you'll know the answer, but maybe you'll surprise me you do know the answer. For the, if you know the answer, it means you're quite a scholar. And the question is a man allowed to marry a pregnant woman?
No.
No, absolutely not. In fact,
you have to wait until so many days after.
Correct. He has to wait three months after the divorce or the death, and that's only the case where she doesn't have a young baby. We'll get to the next case in a second. That's just the next Mishnah where she has a young baby from the previous marriage. But let's say she has no children from the previous marriage. She might, since she's pregnant, so we're afraid that if somebody marries her, we won't be able to determine who the father is. We don't know who the father is. Why? Because, you know, she's in an early stage of pregnancy, so we don't know. Did she get pregnant from? Right, it's not what you call hukar ha'uber. So you can't even know that she's pregnant. So he went ahead and he violated this law. He married a pregnant woman. So again, there's something not kosher about the marriage. But it's not like the cases that we discussed before, where a kohen marries a grusha, a kohen gadol marries an almana, or a man marries a mamzeres. In those cases, there was a clear-cut violation of a Torah law. Here, we're talking about a rabbinic law. Midrabanan, he's not allowed to marry a pregnant woman because we're always afraid maybe somebody will be confused about who the father is.
What if it's a late-stage pregnancy already?
Okay, so we're going to get into all the details in a minute, but let's just have another case. What happens if he marries a woman who's nursing? So she's nursing the baby that she conceived from the previous husband. And the Gemara says that in such a case, she's not allowed to get married. Now again, to understand this, we have to understand the significance of nursing. You know, today, you know, we have, what do they call it? All those things. What do they call it? Yeah, what's it called?
Formula?
Yeah, but what's the famous company? I shouldn't mention the company. Similac. Oh, I don't know, it's called Similac. Materna, excellent. That's what I had in mind. Materna, right? So today,
it's almost ancient history.
Today, you know, the women who give Materna. In Yiddish, we say Nishkefelch. It's not the end of the world. It's not a catastrophe. But in the old days, if a woman does not nurse her baby, it could be very, very dangerous for the baby because they didn't have all the Materna and all the things that we have today. So Chachamim made a takana that a man should not marry a nursing woman, because what happens is if he marries a nursing woman, it could be that she'll conceive from the second husband, and that could undermine her ability to nurse. I'll just read to you, if you're interested, a footnote from the Art Scroll. He says the rabbis decreed that if a husband dies or divorced his wife when his wife was pregnant or nursing, another man may not marry her until the child is 24 months old. How long of a nursing period did Chazal want to guarantee for this child? 24 months of nursing. You know, today's society, I don't know, you know, after already 8, 9 months or 12 months, you know,
12 months is already long.
But two years. And by the way, if you're interested, this has a tremendous impact on the laws of birth control. So there was a Rav Henkin in America, a great rabbi, and he paskin that a couple should space the marriage for a minimum of 2 years to allow the child to nurse. And even if the mother's not nursing, but the same idea, you know, that the mother should give her attention to the baby. And then he extends it even longer than 2 years. But okay, we're not going to get into that now. Okay, so what happens if she runs the risk of a new pregnancy under a second husband that could spoil her milk, and that could even endanger the child? In our mission, the man violated this prohibition. He married a pregnant or a nursing woman. And then, again, the marriage is perfectly legit. I mean, we may ask him to wait a while, you know, wait out the 24 months, but in the meantime, she's married to him. And he gave her kinui, and sure enough, there was stira. So what's the deal in such a case? This is not a forbidden marriage on a Torah level, because we just finished saying that if the marriage is not kosher, then lo shosos v'lo notlos ksuba. But here the marriage is very paradoxical. On the one hand, on a Torah level, it's a perfectly kosher marriage. The Torah never prohibited, never enjoined the man from marrying a pregnant woman or a nursing woman. But once the Rabbanan instituted that Isur, he violates that Isur, the marriage is not 100% kosher. So what would be in such a case? And here we have a machlokes between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. Let's go through the two opinions. The first opinion is Rabbi Meir, lo shosos v'lo notlos ksuba, meaning Rabbi Meir identifies a violation of a marriage derabbanon with that of a doraisa. They are absolutely equivalent. And if she's forbidden to her husband, and he had no right to marry this woman at this point in her life, then it's a non-kosher marriage. It's only mirabbanon. Rabbi Meir says, well, a violation of a derabbanon is very, very serious. And Chachamim, they have a different view. They say, Yochel hu lafrisha ulachziro liachar zman. In this case, we're not going to force him to divorce his wife simply because she was nursing or pregnant, but we're going to say that he has to refrain. You know, maybe they'll live in different houses. I mean, you have to work out the details, but he has to refrain from having an intimate relationship with her during this 24 period, until they wait out the 24-month period. So in that case, there's really no forcing him to divorce his wife. You know, if you want to talk about an illegitimate marriage, you know, a marriage that's against the Torah, that I understand, because then he has to divorce his wife. But in this particular scenario, where the violation of the Isur Drabbanan by marrying either a pregnant woman or a nursing woman does not force him. We even the Rabbanan, even after he violates this Isur, they will not twist his arm until he delivers a divorce. They will require him to wait out to 24 months before he has any sort of intimacy. And therefore, basically, this marriage is kosher. Because your criterion for a non-kosher marriage is whether we force him to divorce his wife. And in this case, we're not going to force him to divorce his wife. So therefore, the Chachamim say that this is not considered a hafka sota. Hafka meaning we don't undermine the law of sota. It's just a separation that he has to separate from her, but he doesn't have to divorce her. And I was very calm about this because I got very nervous initially. If you look at the earlier part of the Mishnah on the top of your page, it says Nesina Li Yisrael. Now, who is this Nesina on the top of page Chavdalet? She is a descendant of the Giv'onim. And David HaMelech made a gzerah, he enacted a rule that we're not allowed to marry any of these descendants of the Giv'onim. Because you may remember that the Givonim fooled Yoshua. They dressed up and they this. Anyway, as a result, these Givonim, the descendants of which were called Nesinim, were seen as a foreign element. They really never got, uprooted their nature that they inherited through. Again, this is a very deep philosophical idea that the Torah has, and I don't know. If you Google this, you won't find anything in Google here about this. This is a very unique Torah perspective. The Torah thinks that bad midos, you know, what we call, unethical behavior, something that is actually transmitted through the genes. Now, I don't know the details, you know, exactly how many generations or what, but in the case of the Givonim, and especially the Nesinim, who were later descendants of the Givonim, they exhibited such barbaric behavior that David HaMelech said we should never marry into that community. That's one community that we don't want their blood mixing with us. And the shakaru of this is that an Amaleki, I mean a descendant of Amalek, could marry into the Jewish faith. If they undergo gerus. Did you ever know that? I mean, the Gemara says in Gittin that B'nai Bonav Shal Haman are teaching Torah in B'nai Brak. So next time you're in B'nai Brak and you hear a Shia, you might want to think if he's the descendant of Haman.
Is it a generational thing, though? Don't they have to wait a generation or two? Or?
I don't know. You have to know the details. You know, that has to do with the Ben Ger Amalek, you know, the fellow who killed Shaul. I mean, if you remember when Shaul fell on his sword, and then David killed the Amaleki because the Amaleki came and he killed Shaul. And Chazal say that that Amaleki was a convert to Judaism. And yet David HaMelech didn't accept his gerus and put him to death. Very strange parsha in Tanakh. But be that as it may, in the case of the Givonim, the Nesinim, David HaMelech made an absolute prohibition. We're not allowed to marry these girls. And this guy, this Jewish guy, married a Nesina. And the question is, does she drink from Emerarim? Because again, the marriage is still valid, although it's not a kosher marriage. And here we're going to farbludgeon him, we're going to beat him up until he divorces his wife. We're not going to tolerate his being married to an Asina. So even though that Easter is only Durabanan, in that sense it's like marrying a pregnant woman or a nursing woman, nevertheless, we're not going to allow her to drink from the Memorarim. Now what's the difference? In both cases, whether it's an Asina, which is Durabanan, or a nursing woman, a Menekes, or a Me'uberes, in all these cases it's only Durabanan. But the answer lies in the words of the Chacham. If you read the Chacham carefully, that's called Yachal Hu Afrisha, which means that it's only a separation period, but we're not going to force him to divorce his wife. Not so in the case of Nesina. In the case of a man marries a Nesina, we're going to force him to divorce his wife. Now the rest of the Mishnah deals with cases of where either he or she has a physiological barrier or a disorder which prevents them from having children. And it's very interesting because when the Torah describes the Me'morarim, it says in the Torah in Parshas Nosa, we should open up the Chumash, maybe we'll do that a little later, that if she survives it, then she will have Zera. That she will actually have a child from her husband. Rabosa, you're all aware of this, right? If you're learning Sota, you know this, that the Torah blesses her and him with a child if she's guiltless, if she drinks from the Me'morarim and she's guiltless. And Chazal understood that that blessing is going to shed a light on the whole institution, the whole enterprise of Sota. That the enterprise of Sota has to fit the following bill. It has to be that there's a possibility that he and she, if she turns out to be innocent, can reconsummate the marriage and they will have children. So if you take a look at the next word in the Mishnah, there's something called an islandess. Now the word islandess is a Greek word which is barred by the Mishnah, and an islandess is a woman who doesn't have simonim. In other words, she will not develop those female symbols that indicate that she's a female, being certain pubic hairs and so forth and so on. We have to go into details about that, and that's one of the interesting sugyas all over Shas about who's, you know, which woman is called an islandess. But the bottom line is that an islandess is a woman who's incapable of having children. And this all reflects on the parish of Sota, because if she cannot possibly have children, just biologically we've proven that she's incapable of having children, then she's not included in the parish. But the real question is, does she have rights to her ksuba? Because she didn't do anything to lose her ksuba. On the other hand, she did kini and stira. Right, so she's claiming, give me an opportunity to prove my innocence. The halacha says she will not be provided with that opportunity because she's an islandess. And she's claiming that, look, it's not my fault, never come an islandess, at least give me the ksuba. You know, you're going to say, because I had kini and stira, he's not allowed to live with me. But I have rights to the ksuba. And the answer is no, you're guilty until proven innocent, my friend, because you had kini and stira. If he was the one who blocked her from having the ability to demonstrate her innocence because he says, I don't want her to drink, or what was the other case?
Dying.
Oh, he had a relationship with her on the way, right? He had an intimacy. In those cases, death was the ambiguous case. But the clear-cut cases are either he blocks her from drinking for the name of Rorim, or he has a relationship with her. And in those two cases, she doesn't drink from Meimron, not through any fault of her own, but through his fault. And therefore, she has rights to Ksuba. So in other words, it shifts from her guilt through Kini and Stira to his blocking her from having the ability to prove her innocence. But in this case of an islandess, she's saying, well, it's not my fault, you know, God bestowed upon me this great blessing that I'm an islandess, and why shouldn't I get the ksuba? And the answer is, you don't deserve a ksuba, because you violated Kenyan stira. Then we have a case of a zakena. This is a woman beyond, what's it called in English?
Postmenopausal?
Menopause, right. She's postmenopausal, so she cannot have children. And in such a case, again, you know, it's not really her fault, but the Torah says she can't drink for the name of Aaron. And what is her fault is that she had Kenyan stira. Then we have another case of Eina Ru'uya Lele. Now, what does this add to the mission? We just had the two cases of Islandess and Zakena, two women who cannot bear children. What is this third case here of a woman who cannot conceive? So this has to do with the laws of Cirrus. Have you ever heard of Cirrus? Cirrus means that in the old days,
sterile.
And yeah, she, you could take a potion and make yourself sterile. And they had, I don't know, today you have to, maybe you can go on Google and tell me what drugs are on the market. You probably can't just buy it, you know, over the counter, but because these are dangerous drugs. But she decided to take a drug and make herself sterile. So in all these cases, lo notlos ksuba velo shosos, that she cannot drink from the main maror, because again the pasuk says zera, that through this process she will be able to conceive children. So she's excluded from shsia. Again, it might not always be through her fault. Certainly not in the last. Certainly not in the first two cases. But nevertheless, she was at fault for kiddush and stira. He'll divorce her without paying the ksuba. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, he says, Yachal hu lisa isha acheres, velifros velibos heimena. In other words, he denies this whole principle that since she cannot have children, the blessing doesn't apply because she won't be able to have children, and therefore she's excluded from drinking from Mei Merorin. Says Rabbi Eliezer, but he could have children in all these three cases. Right? He didn't take a potion to make himself sterile. He can still have a child, and therefore the blessing of this parsha of Sota could apply to him. And therefore the woman in this case who couldn't have children would not be excluded from drinking for the Mei Merorin, because he can be Lifros, Velirbos, Amen. He can marry a different woman and he can have children from another woman. But what happens, my friends, if both she and he are incapable of having children? Then there's no drinking from the Mei Merorin, because again, there's no possibility of fulfilling this part of the parasha, which is the blessing of Zera.
So what will be the reward if they pass the test?
Well, no. In this case, there's no drinking. What's your case? So again, there are three possible scenarios. One is that she can't have children. The other is he can't have children. Right. And the third is neither of them could have children.
Does she get the ksuba then?
Does she get the ksuba? So let's read the next line in the Mishnah, so we don't make any mistake here. There's so many different cases. I want to make sure I don't make a mistake. So again, yachol hu lisa isha cheres velifros velibros heimena. Just 1 second. So again, let's make things clear here. Just as I'm talking to myself, and if I talk out loud and you hear me, maybe you'll gain something from it. Maybe. I'm not promising. The law is like this. In a case where she can drink from the Mei Merorim, then she loses her ksuba until she proves her innocence. And according to Rabbi Eliezer, in this case where he could have children, she will drink from the Mei Merorim. So if you ask me, will she collect the ksuba? The answer is a flat no, unless she proves herself innocent. Okay. So again, I'm going to go over this rule one more time, just so that it sinks into the brain. Any case where she had kiddush and stira and she can drink from the Mei Merorim, she loses her ksuba unless she drinks from the Mei Merorim and proves her innocence. So what happens is, if she doesn't drink from the Mei Merorim in this case, which according to Rabbi Eliezer she has to drink from the Mei Merorim, but let's say for whatever reason she doesn't,
she loses
then He has to divorce her because the Kenyan's there, and she loses her gesu. Now the next part of the Mishnah is Veshar Kol Hanoshim Oshosos Olonotlos Ksuba. And this, I think, is more or less a formulation of the rule that I just gave you now, that with regard to any woman who's included in the parasha of Mei Merorim, she loses her ksuba if she doesn't drink. So remember, we had the case before where she decides that she doesn't want to drink for the Mei Merorim. Well, she forfeits her ksuba. Now, I'm wondering if he's going to ask my question here. This is going to... He's going to ask my question. This is a repeat of what we've already studied, because we already had the case where she refused to drink from the Mei Merorim, and we said she loses her ksuba. So what is the Mishnah telling me here when it says Shar Kol HaNashim Shosos, meaning either they drink, or Lo Notlos Ksuba? So this seems to be a repetition of what we know before. So he gives an answer here. What does he say? On the rabbinic law, in this case, the marriage is... I don't know. Take a look at footnote number 24 if you happen to have the article. I'm not sure what he's saying here. I think what he's saying is that this part of the Mishnah is going back on the case of Muberes and Meinika. But I don't know if that's true. But let's see if we can finish up the Mishnah. Eishes Kohen. This is unbelievable. What's the chiddush here? As Alan would always say, what's the chiddush? The wife of a Kohen drinks Mei Merorim. Why would I think otherwise? And if she drinks for the Mei Merorim and she turns out to be guiltless, Muteres Levayel, she goes back to her husband. I mean, why would I think otherwise?
Right.
This is obvious. Next case. What happens if he cannot bear children, but she could bear children? So the Mishnah says, Eishes Saris Shosa. So this is going to be a sugya later on.
Why would you think not?
Yeah. I think you would think not because he cannot get to bracha since he's a saris. But since at the time of the Kenyan stira, he was healthy, so that already puts her into the parasha of Sota, and the fact that he becomes sterile later on is not going to remove the parasha of Sota. But I don't know, for that we'd have to see the Gemara and Daf Chof Daladom in Bates.
Oh, but hang on a second. Vice versa.
Right. Yeah, we're going to have to go through this. So I plead the fifth right now. We'll give me a few minutes to get through the Gemara. Okay, finally, Al Yidei Kol Arayos Mekanin. What happens if he warns her not to have a secluded, you know, not to go into seclusion with a man who she's not allowed to marry? For example, let's say she says, I don't want you to go into a private place with your brother or with your father or any of the other Arayos. So that's also included in Kenyan's theory. You might think, well, that's not a valid Kenyan. She, in any event, she's not allowed to have a relationship. But the Mishnah says no, since the marriage is a valid marriage, and even though the Kenyan is to an erva, it doesn't matter. The Kenyan is valid. Chutz, which person is the only person that is excluded from Kenyan? Meaning, if she points to him, there's no Kenyan. Hakatan. Now, what does the word katan mean? By sheer association, you know, if I wake you up in the middle of the night, what is a katan?
A boy.
Less than 13 years old. That's not what it means here. Chutzman katan means he's a boy less than 9 years old.
Under puberty.
Less than 9 years old. I don't know about puberty. Don't hit me with puberty. I'm just saying he's under 9 years old. Why? Because if this boy is 9 years old, then the Torah recognizes his bia. You might be shocked about that. Yeah. So that's, I'm telling you something that maybe you don't know.
Yeah.
And then there's something called Misha Eino Ish. What's Misha Eino Ish? So that's a very ambiguous phrase. Misha Eino Ish.
Yeah, one is not a man.
What does that mean?
Uh, that he so doesn't have a shemonim?
There's a whole sugya on what does it mean, Misha Eino Ish. I don't know, in my book it says to look in footnote 29.
He's wrapped up in the rainbow flag.
He says that the Gemara will explain what it means, a man who's not a man. So I guess art school didn't know the answer either.
It's a rainbow man.
No. That he doesn't have the
I don't know
physical,
what a rainbow man
he doesn't have the physical organs.
It's called a eunuch.
Okay.
A grovinus.
Now, is there any situation in which the man, the husband, did not give her kinui, but will give her kinui in place of the husband? The Elush Bezdin Makanin Lahem. Here's a list of cases where he was incapable of giving her kinui. She misbehaved, and we really suspect that something's going on over here. So Bezdin themselves will, if I can use an American phrase, if you don't mind, will step up to the plate, and they'll give her kinui in place of the husband. Number one, the first case is Sheneschareish Baila. Now, let's not misunderstand this. A lot of people make this mistake. Nischareish, which literally means he became deaf, that's not what it means. The word cheresh is referring to a deaf mute. He doesn't speak. Next, nishtate, or he became a shote. Now there are four ways in which a man becomes a shote. Four, what we call simoni shtus. And once he gets to that stage, if she's misbehaving and she's, you know, guilty of promiscuous behavior, then Bezdin will step in his place and they'll give her the kinui. Osha Yechavish Bebeis Asurim, he's locked up in jail. They don't give him any Facebook or any WhatsApp, so he has no way of communicating his kinui, and she's misbehaving. And therefore, Bezdin is going to give her the kinui. Now, how far are we going to go with this? Let's say she violates the kinui of Bezdin. Does she drink Mei Mararin? So the Mishnah says, Lolash Kosa Omru, because again, the precondition of Mei Mararin is that he brings her to the Kohen to drink. But here he's locked up in jail, or he's not, his mind is not functioning properly. Elo leposla miksuva. The only significance, and this is pretty significant, of kinui and stira is that she loses her ksuva if she violates the kinui of Bezdin. Now, I don't understand why the Mishnah has to tell me that. Why doesn't the Mishnah go a step further and say that he's not allowed to resume his relationship with her? 32, let's just see if anybody, okay, if anybody asks this question, one who issued again, caught one his wife, the effect of the question is limited to her, oh, there it is, he quotes the Meiri at the end of footnote number 32, the Meiri says that the impact and the repercussion of the court's warning is number one, to prohibit her to her husband if she violates the kinui. And number two, she forfeits her ksuba. She doesn't have the option of proving herself innocent by drinking for the Mei Mararin. Why not? Because that is preconditioned for that, is that he brings her to drink from the Mei Mararin, and he can't do so. Bezdin did so, but that's not enough to effectuate the process of her drinking for the Mei Mararin. So if she violates the warning of Bezdin, she's in deep trouble. Because number one, she can never resume her relationship with her husband. And it's even more severe than that, I'll explain in just a minute. And number two, she loses her ksuba. And she doesn't have any option whatsoever to drink from Mei Mararin. She is basically locked up in jail over here. She has no way out. Now, why do I say that the fact that she cannot resume her relationship with her husband is a very severe situation? Because what would allow this woman to ever get married again? What does she need to get married? A get, right?
Her husband to die.
Well, she can kill her husband, but let's say she's not into murder. So, you know, they won't let her get into the jail to murder her husband. So the only option she has is to get a get from her husband. Now, getting a get from your husband in these cases is very tricky. If he's in a beis hasurim, possibly. You know, we'd have to get two witnesses into the jail if they'd allow that, and he would have to instruct the two witnesses, blah, blah, blah. But in the cases that we discussed about number one, a cheresh, and number two, a shota, she's in really deep trouble. This is one of the few cases in halacha where a woman could never marry anybody. I mean, again, unless he, Baruch Hashem, he has, you know, in the case of the shtata, you know, he can be cured. In the case of a deaf mute, whoa, that's complicated. that could be an irreversible situation. That reminds me of the case of a woman who lost her husband. Her husband was, and she was childless, and her husband left a brother, and he's a deaf mute. Uh-huh. It's not no joke. I mean, uh-huh. That's what my Rebbe used to always say, that in the Kiruv operations, they tell you that Judaism is a bowl of cherries. You know, everything is wonderful. Shabbos is wonderful. Yom Tov is wonderful. It's good for the digestive system, you know, and so forth and so on. But the truth is that Yadus, that Yiddishkeit, is as tough as nails. It's really tough.
Doesn't Yibum have some kind of qualifications?
For sure, but I'm worried about Chalitza. He's not capable of doing Chalitza. So, for example, if let's say her brother-in-law, her surviving brother-in-law is a newborn baby, so she's going to have to wait 13 years till she can get married. That's not pleasant. But at least there's an end at the end of 13 years.
Okay.
But in this case, if he's a cherish,
He shouldn't be qualified, so Chalitza shouldn't apply.
Correct. So she's gonna remain what's called a Shomeres Yavam for the rest of her life. She can never get remarried.
There should be an exception.
Okay. We'll let you write the book. That's why we have other denominations in Judaism, right? Because they try to make exceptions, but in our denomination. You know what I'm saying? I don't care who you vote for in the next election, but in our Yiddishkeit, there is no, you know what I'm saying? There's no way out.
Wow.
These are tragedies. I'll give you another example, which is also tragic, but not as tragic, a little less. If a woman is married to a Kohen and she gets raped by a guy, that's it. Mm. He has to divorce her. Wow. There's no exception, but you can't rewrite the script. So that's why I say that my Rebbe used to always say that He used to say that the symbol of Judaism is the Mizbeach, you know, is the altar, because the Mizbeach represents Mesiras Nefesh. He had a case, my Rebbe, unbelievable case, where he was Makarev, a Jew, to Yiddishkeit, and so this Baal Tshuva was very, very hard for him to find a shidduch for whatever reason. And finally he found a young girl, and they fell in love, and the Rav was said to be Masada Kedushin. But there's a minhag, I don't know if you're familiar with it, that before you get married, you go to the cemetery.
Yes.
You know, we call it gezeigeznoch, I don't know how you say it in English, but to sort of get your parents, you know, some grandparents. Yeah. So this man, who was a Baal Tshuva, he went to the cemetery. It was the first time he was at the cemetery. It was his grandfather's cemetery. And he saw a symbol on the cemetery. That means that his grandfather was a Kohen.
Oh.
And the Rav had the greatest pleasure, so to speak, to have to break up the engagement before the marriage. Mm. So that's when Judaism becomes tough as nails. Wow. You know, there's no way out.
But why did he have to break up the marriage?
Because he's a Kohen. He had no clue he was a Kohen.
Yeah.
And he's not allowed to marry this woman because she was a Giora. So I forgot to tell you that. Sorry. Well,
thank you.
I forgot to tell you that.
He was the Giora, is what you said. Yeah.
He was the Baal Tshuva and she was the Giora. So. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Aflash Kosel. Rabbi Yossi says that the authority of Beis Din to substitute for the husband in this case and give her kinui, And then she violated the kinui, goes as far as Lashkosa, meaning that Beis Din here has the same status as the Baal. You know, they're representing the Baal here all the way. And they have the same Gushpanka, you know, as the Baal himself. And therefore, if she violates this stira, the kinui of the Beis Din, she will drink from the main Merarin. Now that could be good news for her, because maybe she'll be innocent, and if she's innocent, then she could resume her relationship with her husband. Again, that's not a pleasant relationship because he's a shota or a cheresh. But at least there's, you know, she's proven herself guiltless, and she'll certainly have rights to live with her husband and to collect the ksuba. Now, l'chiyetze balam beis asurim yashkena. In other words, if we anticipate that in the third case of these three that a husband will be freed from his jail, then he will take her to be mashka based on the kinyan steer that was afforded in his absence by the Beis Din. In the case of a cheresh or a shota, then she would have to go through with the ashkas sota even without a husband, because now she has to drink from the main Mararim. Now, if you take a look at footnote number 33, Rav Yossi doesn't accept the second exposition presented in the previous note. Okay, so this we didn't go through. This is Gemara Kosein. All right, we'll say, how much time do we have? Do we have 3 minutes?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay, so 2 minutes. Let's just start. We'll start the Gemara just to get a feeling that, you know, the Gemara is going to go through each one of these cases. We have the Mishnah, which itself is, I think, a great achievement. And again, I would implore you to review the Mishnah over and over again. So now the Gemara is medayik in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that she was an arusa or a shomeres yavam. And in these cases, the Mishnah says that she loses two things. Number one, she's out of the parish of drinking. She can't drink for the main Marorim. She's going to have to get divorced from her husband. And not only that, she doesn't collect her ksuba. So the Gemara is medayik. Mishta hu delo shasya. She doesn't drink. Ha, but however, kinui makanila. But the kinui itself is meaningful. In other words, that since he gave her a kinui, prohibiting her from secluding with herself with such a man, that means that the kinui is totally effective. It's valid. And if she violates the kinui, then although she won't drink for the name of Rarim, but she's no longer capable of resuming her relationship with her husband, and she loses her ksuba, minani mili. What's the basis for this ruling? How do we know that in these cases where there's no shasia because the ishus is incomplete, maybe the Torah removed her from the whole parasha, including Kini and Steer, right? There's a package deal in Parashas Naso in this section, excuse me, of the Torah. A, B, and C. A is Kini, B is Stira, and C is Shtia Mimayim Hamararim. If the Torah excludes these categories of marriage, because as we said before, they're incomplete, from the parasha of Sota, why do we assume that's only with regard to Shasia? Maybe she's completely excluded from the whole parasha, and the kinui itself is not valid. Because the Torah says the kinui is valid when that kinui could culminate ultimately with a shasiyah. Mm-hmm. But if it can't culminate with a shasiyah, then that new parasha of kinui, which was presented by the Torah here in Sota, doesn't apply. These women are completely excluded from A to Z from the parasha of Sota, and therefore there's no kinui. Mm-hmm. And if there's no kinui, she's in good shape, because that means she didn't violate the kinui through stira. And she can resume our relationship with her husband-to-be, in the case of Arusa, meaning there's going to be Nisuin. She can resume our relationship with her husband-to-be in the case of a Yavam. Again, he has a choice whether to give a Yivam or Chalitza, but in the event that he's Miyavim, then the relationship is a very, very solid relationship. And now the Gemara is going to quote a Braisa to prove that the kinui in the case of an arus and shomeres yavam is a valid kinui. Why? Because it says Dabrel b'nei Yisrael v'yamarta, and whenever you see the word v'yamarta, there's some sort of a ribui, some sort of an inclusion. L'rabos, this is coming to include. This is the opening verse in the parash of Sota, and it says l'rabos arusa v'shomeres yavam l'kinui. And if there's kinui, then it could be stira. And the result of the steer is that even though she cannot drink from my Mararim because they're not a full-fledged Ishus, she'll be Asur al-Baila, she cannot resume her relationship, and she will forfeit her Ksum. Okay, my friends? So we'll call it a day for today, and we'll see if we can plow ahead tomorrow. Again, it's you have to have a lot of patience here, because there's a lot of information that we're being hit with, and we have to build it up step by step. Okay then?
Yes, sure.
That's what we have.